open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
You have to fashion just the situation that will heat temper your character.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Today, Bonnie Jo Campbell says when she starts a new story, she pictures an interesting character in a tough situation.
That gives me something to worry about. And once I've got something to worry about, then I can keep myself up at night and I can keep that character with me during the day and that with everything I'm doing, so I can really ponder the life of that character.
Bonnie Jo grew up in Western Michigan, and her stories draw on her experiences with the dark side of rural life. Her latest collection of stories is called Mothers, Tell Your Daughters. She talks this hour with poet, essayist, and undertaker Thomas Lynch. Campbell starts off the program talking about her book, American Selvage.
Tom has asked me to read basically a whole very short story from the collection American Selvage. So I'm going to read this, and it's a little bit rough. It contains rough material, but have faith in the story that it'll move you through the material. This is called The Solutions to Brian's Problem. Solution number one. Connie said she was going out to the store to buy formula and diapers. While she's gone, load up the truck with the surround sound home entertainment system and your excellent collection of power tools. Put the baby boy in the car seat and drive away from this home you built with your two hands. Expect that after you leave, she will break all the windows in the living room, including the big picture window, as well as the big mirror over the fireplace, which you've already replaced twice. The furnace will run and run. Solution number two. Wait until Connie comes back from the store. Distract her with the baby, and then cut her meth with Drano so that when she shoots it up, she dies. Solution number three. Put the baby to bed in his crib and sit on the living room couch until Connie comes home. Before she has the chance to lie about where she's been, grab her hair and knock her head into the fireplace that you built from granite blocks that came from the old chimney of the house your great-grandfather built when your family first came to this country from Finland. Blocks you gathered from the old foundation in the woods. Don't look at the wedding photos on the mantle. Don't look at Connie's wide wedding day smile or the way her head tilts back in ecstasy that seems to have nothing to do with drugs. Don't let the blood stop you from hitting her one final time to make sure you have cracked her skull. Put her meth and her bag of syringes and blood-smeared needles in her hand so the cops find them when they arrive. Solution number four, just go. Head south where it's warm. After a few hours, pull over at a truck stop and call your mother to warn her. After that, pretend not to have a wife and baby. When put to the test, Connie might well rise to the occasion of motherhood. Contact the union about getting a job with another local. Resist taking any photographs along with you, especially the photographs of your baby at every age. Wipe your mind clear of memories, especially the memory of your wife first telling you she was pregnant and how that pregnancy and her promise to stay clean made everything seem possible. Do not remember how the two of you kept holding hands that night, how you couldn't stop reaching for each other, even in your sleep. She lost that baby and the next one. And although you suspected the reason, you kept on trying. There are seven solutions. Solution number five, blow your head off with the 12 gauge you keep behind the seat of your truck. Load the shotgun with shells, put the butt against the floor, rest your chin on the barrel, and pull the trigger. Let your wife find your bloody headless corpse in the living room. Let her scrape you off these walls. Maybe that will shock her into straightening up her act. Let her figure out how to pay the mortgage and the power bill. Solution number 6, call a helpline. Talk to a counselor. Explain that last week your wife stabbed you in the chest while you were sleeping, that she punches you too, giving you black eyes that you have to explain to the guys at work. Explain that you're in danger of losing your job, your house, your baby. Tell her Connie has sold your mountain bike and some of your excellent power tools already, that you have been locking the remainder in your truck, which you park a few blocks from the house now. Try to be patient when the counselor seems awkward in her responses, when she inadvertently expresses surprise at the nature of your distress, especially when you admit that Connie is only 5 foot tall. Expect the counselor to be even less supportive when you say, "Hell yes, you hit her back." Tell the counselor that it's the little things too, that at least once a week she rearranges things in the house, not only the furniture, but your financial files and the food, all of which last week she moved into the basement, including the milk and the meat, which you then had to throw away. Then realize that the counselor probably has caller ID. Hope that the counselor doesn't call social services because a baby needs his mama. Assure the counselor that Connie's a good mama. She's good with the baby. The baby is in no danger. Solution number 7. Make dinner for yourself and your wife with the hamburger in the fridge. Sloppy Joe's maybe, or goulash with the stewed tomatoes your mother canned. Your mother, who like the rest of your family, thinks your wife is just moody. You haven't told them the truth because it's too much to explain. It's too much to explain that, yes, you knew she had this history when you married her, when she got pregnant, but you thought you could kick it together. You thought that love could mend all broken things. Wasn't that the whole business of love? Mix up some bottles of formula for later tonight when you will be sitting in the living room feeding the baby, watching the door of the bathroom, behind which your wife will be searching for a place in her vein that has not hardened or collapsed. When she finally comes out, brush her hair back from her face and try to get her to eat something. Thanks.
Yeah, babe. Oh. Every time the impulse to tip into telling us something in the black and white range, you just go grayer and grayer. We have to, as a student once said to me, "Oh, you mean the reader gets to finish it?"
Or thank keep you for on that. Pondering
or keep
it.
Or keep on pondering it. That's right. I have to confess that I came from a culture of people where the men were expected to grow up and become either priests or alcoholics, and I always feel like I should say, "My name is Tom, and I am not a priest." But I do spend some time sort of in this type of arrangement with people because I am, as it turns out, a crackerjack obituarist. I like telling stories about people, albeit recently deceased people, but from the end to the beginning. And if it's not too much of a hardship, I would like to sort of investigate the spaces in your biography that will eventually become what we call the highlights, and or watersheds, however you want to look at it. And if this is uncomfortable, you can just say, "Go bag your ass, Lynch. You'll be all right with me. I've had teenagers. You can't hurt my feelings." So, but what I really want to know is, you were born in 1962. I have that right. And you grew up on a farm where the house was built by your maternal grandfather. Mm-hmm. His name was Erlahi. A bad dose of it there, so you you have some splaining to do, as they say in West Clare. And your parents were divorced when you were 7. Mm-hmm. Do I have that right? Mm-hmm. And so you grew up with your mother as the second of five children on what could be called a kind of survival working farm, or fill in the blanks here. I'm trying to.
Yeah, when my after my parents got divorced, my mom, she had always loved horses, and she's always had a horse, and this piece of property that she lived on was belonged to my grandfather, so she got this house, and she had 8 acres, and she had always admired the local farmers, and you know, if there's any dwindling resource in this country that is underappreciated, it is old farmers and old farm wives, and you know, they know so much. And so she went and talked to some farmers and decided she was going to become a farmer, and so went and got some runt piglets and got some calves that she could raise and sell, the main thing was a milk cow and some chickens. So we just became farmers, and so us five kids became farm kids at this age.
A cow, some pigs, some chickens, a little bit of land, an admiration for farmers.
Yeah.
This is the stuff of which dreams are made of.
Yeah,
right?
And she really did it. And you know, there was a time when it was actually, she saved money doing it. Now I think people who choose a farming life, they have to work a job to pay for the farming life.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and so I think this was kind of a magical time where she actually said, I got all these kids, we need milk. And
we
then
won't
we got
starve.
This, yeah, we got this mean milk cow named Red. She was so mean. She wasn't even a proper milk cow. She was like half Hereford, half Ayrshire. It was a crazy mix. And so mom learned, my mom always was crippled. She had a crippled arm, but she somehow learned to like lift that arm up and do the milking. And so, you know, she was milking that cow. She also, with this arm, you know, managed to lug bale, you know, 50-pound bags of oats. I don't know how she did it. It was kind of miraculous.
The word hard scrabble turns up in some of the reviews of your work, but your mother sounds like a hard scrabble woman.
Yeah, she was
not a
tough
woman to be tampered with.
Well, I think she loves being tampered with, actually. Those who have met her, you know.
As we do.
But in the right way.
Yes, yes.
So, but I think she was just kind of determined to live a certain kind of life. And I think having a mother who is a character, that's all I can say about it, is we write fiction, and what we have to believe as fiction writers is that your character determines your destiny.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always work out in life that way, but that's how fiction works, or it wouldn't be satisfying. And so my mother actually did behave like a fictional character.
She saw herself as apart from herself.
Yeah, yeah, well, she. I don't know if she sees herself as a fictional character, but I could see how a lot of times in fiction we talk about how the character must be driven by desire.
Yeah.
And my mother, when she got a desire like this to have a farm, she would, she followed it. And so us watching her, and often, as in literature, the problem with following a desire is that other things get neglected sometimes.
Yeah.
And so she was a great thing as a writer, you know, in the egg, you know, watching, you know, having a mother like this watching her was actually probably a good formative thing for a writer.
I don't want to budge from the obituarial model, but I do want to, since you've brought it up, the notion of character and narrative and setting and language. These are elements of fiction that incipient writers are always being told. If it's not serving one of these purposes, it's not doing its job. Or as I think Dutch Leonard said years ago, leave out the parts that people won't read. So, which is very helpful. But in your stories, I sometimes sense that one of those things is, it has given you access to these people and such. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, is it the character you fall in love with and just turn them loose within your sentences? Is it the setting? Is it Comstock and Kalamazoo and, you know, the down market southwest corner of Michigan and the people that inhabit those spaces? Or is it the joy of writing sentences that just, I mean, they make the mouth glad to say them aloud, you know.
Aww,
this. You must
so
say
nice
them to yourself out loud, do you know?
Well, they I do read them out loud many times in the process of trying to revise these things. I guess what gives me the impulse to write a story is to have envision, well, I'll say it one way and then I'll say it another way, is that I need to have in mind a very interesting character in a very tough situation. Yeah. And that gives me something to worry about. And once I've got something to worry about, then I can keep myself up at night and I can keep that character with me during the day and that with everything I'm doing, so I can really ponder the life of that character. And then I think the way I write, and I'll probably contradict this later in the conversation, is that I have the character in the situation, and then the character has to be really interesting to me. You know, it takes me years to write these things, so I really do have to be interested in the situation. Mm. And I'm the worst writing student, because they put you in a class and they're like giving a little assignment and saying, write about it right now. And it's like, you know, if you can only write about things you care desperately about, it's kind of hard, like somebody gives you a little, you know, like, imagine you're a dog and you're in a car. I don't know. Although actually,
and you're out of gas.
Yeah. But I get the character getting more and more interesting, and then I have to fashion a situation that allows that character to be the most that character can be. And in order to see what a character's made of, you have to put that character through the fire.
Pages, that's right.
Yeah, you gotta put that, because you gotta see what that character is made of. So you have to fashion just the situation that will heat temper your character. And then once you figure out what that situation is, you may find you need to change the character a little and develop the character, give that character a backstory so that to make this make more sense, what is happening in the now situation, you may have that. And or you may have a fabulous ending to this story, and then you gotta go back and make sure that the story matches the ending, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, you wish you could just write these things.
It has to do with construction and mathematics, I dare say. And this returns us to the obituarial thing. You left home to go to university. You were 18, I suppose, or thereabouts.
So, yeah, I think 17.
You went to the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I went to L.A. for a year. I know, it's crazy. It's a crazy thing to do.
Was that
because they sent me like this glossy brochure, and they didn't really, like, I don't know if you guys, guidance counselors, what they do now, but I think they just drank a lot of tea when I was in school. Because how I decided to go to California is just like, I didn't have any like thing, and nobody in my family really was that interested, but they had got this glossy brochure and I applied to University of Southern California and then just flew out there and showed up. So they were like, well, what are we supposed to do with you? And I was like,
you thought they would just take you in?
Yeah, I didn't
based
know.
On the brochure.
Yeah, Well, I'd apply and they'd accepted me.
Yeah, well, there's that.
I know. So, yeah. But anyway, so it was kind of like there was a little negotiating to do. But anyway, I was there for a year and I figured out it wasn't really the place for me.
Yeah.
It was, but they had an honors program that was based on the University of Chicago honors program.
At
this school. And so what they said to me was like, you really belong. We just have a feeling you belong at the University of Chicago. And they helped me like get in somehow.
And you studied
philosophy. Naturally.
At Chicago. Yes, it falls in there
as
someplace. As one would, that's right. Because there's an awful lot of work in that field now.
Well, we were gonna, my mom thought that I would open up a philosophy shop. Because I think there's one in Terry Pratchett, isn't there? A philosophy shop?
I don't know, I only deal with florists in that
town.
Oh,
okay, yeah. And there were, and you know, the bait shop had just closed, so we thought it would be a good fit.
And philosophy.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was
night crawlers and Bishop Barkley.
Which was my first job, selling night crawlers to the bait shop. That was my first job.
I knew I liked you.
Yeah.
So I
got a nickel. A nickel each.
This is a siren song, but so you finished school at the University of Chicago. Your mother had rented out your room, so where
there were a lot of people living there when I went home. There were like many, there were like 12 or 13 people living
there.
Did
you ever forgive her for that, or did you ever have a conversation about it?
Oh, no, it was fine. I understood. Oh, yeah. What are you going to do, make it into like a shrine, you know?
They do. You know?
Well, but there were these bills to pay.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were always, and my mom took in a lot of people who were like down on their luck.
Yeah.
And, you know, kids would show up in town and like nowhere to go. They would send them to
what
my mom.
What year did you make it to Western Michigan University to study math?
Well, it was because I there were so many people living in my mom's house that I decided I would bicycle to Boston. And I wanted to quit smoking. And I thought, I'll just... That'd be an easy way to quit smoking.
That would
It'd
come
be
to
like
my
bicycle.
Mind almost immediately, yeah.
Well, if you're biking all the time. So I bicycled to Boston, where I had some cousins there, and they had a boarding house.
Who also didn't smoke, no doubt.
Yeah, actually, I started smoking again when I got there. Because it was fun. And I learned about drinking coffee there and stuff, you know.
I'm trying to find out when, after you got tired of math,
oh, yeah, there I got interested. Well, I loved math at University of Chicago. I was studying philosophy, but, you know, it was the kind of school where the really cool people were studying math. I mean, those were the cool people, and they had math tea every Friday afternoon, and I got invited to math
tea. That sounds
tea.
Pretty exciting.
It was very exciting, and these people were smart. You could see, like, their brains, like, throbbing inside their heads, and I really loved math dudes. And, you know, I just love to hang around.
Throbbing brains inside there. I get it.
Yeah. And I just love to hear about number theory and, you know.
Prime numbers.
Yeah, I could talk about prime numbers with you.
With digits from here to Chicago.
Yeah.
Divisible by one and by themselves.
Oh, yeah.
I love it when you talk like that. Anyway, what I'm getting at is I want to know when you gave up a future in throbbing numbers.
It was because of my math. I was in a PhD program.
Right.
And in mathematics, of course. And my mathematics advisor was Dr. Arthur White. And, you know, he was just a joy. And he was the one who encouraged me to join this PhD program. And then after a while, whenever I would do math, I mean, math is great, it's so beautiful, it's so concise, and you prove beautiful things. But I was like crying all the time. I was just
a
weeping.
Sign of something, yeah.
I would sit down to prove theorems, and it would, you know, and he saw my tear-stained pages, and my math advisor, and he said, it's all well and good, and I had just gotten my master's, which you do along the way, and he said, maybe you should go take a writing class. My math advisor did. And he said, isn't Stu Dybeck teaching a class over there?
Yeah.
On the other side. And he sent me over there.
And what year was this, Bonnie?
I don't know, something like 95, maybe.
95?
Yeah.
You're saying that was, is that 20 years ago now?
Golly. Go figure.
95.
How's it happen, yeah.
So you took your math professor's advice, you went over to the creative writing department, and fell in with the likes of Stu Dybeck.
And Jamie Gordon.
Jamie Gordon, who
National Book Award winner.
Changed everything for you.
Yeah, she said I wrote good stories. Which the guy at University of Chicago, I took one fiction class, and I can quote him, he said, "Did I epitomize all that was wrong with fiction today?" Well, I was only like 19,
what
of
was
course
his name? What was
never,
his name so we can send a card?
I can never remember his name, but it was like Stern or Stein.
Well, you've
or
said
something.
Enough. You don't remember his name.
I know,
name.
And then he died. And I was like, God, I can't even like dislike him anymore because he's dead. I know.
It's like Corpse 101.
Yeah.
Be nice to the dead guy. Yeah.
He was okay, but he shouldn't have said that, you know. He shouldn't have said that.
But Jamie said that you had an aptitude for stories, so it took you about 3 weeks before you wrote Women and Other Animals? Do I have that right?
Those were the stories I worked. She convinced me to leave the math department and join the writing department, and it was very nice. You know, it's nice to have somebody saying nice things and inviting you on board, and you know, and she really kind of, she was kind of bossy actually about it.
Yeah.
And I like that.
We'll talk. But it was 1995. You published Women and Other Animals was your first published collection of stories.
Yeah, that's when, and I wrote those while I was getting my MFA program.
Right, which, and you published that in 2000 and...
1999, and then I think
okay,
it came
so
out...
Okay, so 4 years yeah. from I'm going to be a math whiz to I'm going to be a National Book Award finalist. Do I have that right, 4 years? 1995, 1999.
Yeah.
Is that 4 years? So that was nice, the way that worked out. And you were probably... and shortly after that, you published... And I want to question you about this, too, without getting away from the obituarial
okay,
format.
Okay, now we'll come back to that. But I do like this deviant.
Do you mind?
No, I'm all for it. Okay. I'm a deviant.
Yeah. My dad used to say, just ask open-ended questions. It'll work itself out. So here's the thing I want to know. You said once, I saw this in an interview, that your novels are failed stories. You said it again today to those wonderful students we were speaking to. Novels
well,
are failed stories.
Who in their right mind would set out to write a novel? It's so hard. Have you guys done it? It's like so hard. They're so long. So much has to happen. And every dang sentence in there has to go with every other dang sentence in there. All the way from the beginning to the end, it's like one has to connect to the next, has to connect to the next, has to reflect all those that came before, has to foreshadow all those that are to come. And there's a lot of them in there.
It's like that formula that Good Will Hunting had on the blackboard.
Yeah. So I always try to write a short story, and then sometimes it doesn't work out. Sometimes it doesn't wrap up.
And that became Kew Road.
Yeah.
Which was published in?
In, I think, 2002.
So 3 years from your first collection of stories to
yeah.
I knock was really out your panicked. First novel.
I was really panicked about it. I did think I couldn't write a novel, and then I just, you know, the minute I think I can't do something, I really buckle down to do it. And then, so that's how I did it.
And
so.
The thing for obituaries is you only have, it's like being the president of the Rotary Club. Once you've done it, once is enough. You become a novelist as soon as you've signed for your first novel.
Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds good.
That's why they don't
pay
me
the
big bucks.
I know, so why did I do it again? So
so you did, you committed this fiction in its short form and in its longer form, all within a space of a few years of having decided you weren't going to be a mathematician. Did you think in your brain box that you were going to take up teaching math?
I did. That's why, and I was the only person ever to get an MFA. I can't believe that I'm the only person ever in the department at Western to get, while I'm so practical that I already had a certification to teach mathematics in the public school, and get this, I am certified, I'm the only person in the state certified to teach philosophy in the secondary schools, because when they found out that that was still an option, and after I got it, they closed it down. So I said...
And none of them could castrate pigs.
No, so yeah. We could do that. So
or milk a cow.
Yeah. So, but I thought it would be practical to add on, if I was going to do this frivolous thing of getting this MFA, I might as well at the same time get a teaching certification for English. So now I also have the certification for teaching English in the public school. So I actually thought... If the philosophy shop didn't work out, I could open up my own charter school, and it would just be me teaching everything.
It's always good to have plan B. And I can tell you, you look very good in black, so if the writing doesn't work out, call.
Oh, I could do the more, okay. I could
swinging doors, carrying flowers, it'll work out. Yeah.
Okay, good.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, more of Thomas Lynch's conversation with Bonnie Jo Campbell.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return now to Thomas Lynch's conversation with Bonnie Jo Campbell.
I do want to ask, and this again is a off the beaten path of your obituary, though I think it would probably get it into the easterly and westerly coastal papers if you included some mention of this. And I want to know about your asses. But tell me about Don Quixote and what's your other fellow, Jack?
Jack, yeah. I named after Jack Driscoll. And Don Quixote, of course.
That'll go in his obituary.
Yeah. I have two fine asses. And my mother, part of the farming thing, when she became a farmer, she also became a horse trader. And it really is a rough business, that horse trading. There are so many interesting horses that pass through. My mom used to do a lot of artwork, and at one point we had a big window, and we had curtains where she had drawn a picture of all the horses we'd ever had, and it's really all the horses, and they were in colors and all their colors. But what happens when you do horse trades is they'll just throw in a donkey. They just do.
Yeah.
So we always had donkeys around.
Yeah.
And just for fun, and they'll keep a horse company, they'll mow your pasture, they don't really need to eat that much, they're really pretty easy to take care of. And so we just always kept the donkeys. We ended up, and they last, if you actually take care of your donkeys, they will live to be at least 40. And if you, a horse will last to 30 if you get good care, but those donkeys really last. And so I do have two fine donkeys, Jack and Don Quixote, and if you can find lots of pictures of them online. But I will say that one thing that's interesting about them is that we had Jenny, of course. Jack and Jenny are the standard donkey names, but mine is special because mine is Jack Driscoll. But Jack and Jenny, I should tell you, Jenny was 40. And she had a baby, and we had to get rid of the baby, and because we didn't want the baby to breed the mom, and so we get rid of the boy baby, and we trade him for Jack, who is not related. So Jack is very young, but we decided we did not want Jenny at age 40 to have another baby, so we got Jack castrated. Well, the vet hands them to you like you're supposed to do something. He's like, hold these, I didn't know if I was supposed to eat them or bury them or what, but,
This is detailed, by the way, as one of the later subsections, which I see as like a sonnet sequence, these lovely vignettes that are part of,
Daughters of the Animal Kingdom.
Daughters of the Animal Kingdom, in which you consider slugs and what's the bivalves or something? It's wonderful. I have sympathetic pains, as we do. And because I had a six-year-old, Charles was six when he was castrated, because he'd gone donkey mad. He'd spent the autumn with four mare asses that belonged to a neighbor of mine. And I just thought, well, the more the merrier. I'd had fantasies, et cetera. But he came back ruined. I mean, he thought he was God's gift. So we had to, he was going after the fetlocks of all the mares and, show horses and stuff.
Yeah.
I said, in this economy, you'll get a bullet in the head if this doesn't work. So, but maybe we should,
I could be a part of this conversation.
You were a part of this. Do you think I ever would have noticed this unless I was on trying to find the good ink? I was looking up ink on your new book. But how do you do that? How do you get people to be so enthused about, really enthused about the experience of your fiction?
I am a little overwhelmed, I'm a little overwhelmed that, you work. It's a marvelous thing that somehow, sometimes, we work hard and get the right thing onto the page at the right time, and some other people like it. It's just really miraculous.
Is it joyous for you, Bonnie Jo?
It is.
Do you
really
feel real joy?
It is really joy. I mean, it's a little overwhelming because it's like when, there's pie, and there's one piece of pie that's really bigger than the other pieces, and it's the one you want, but you're not gonna ask for it because that would just be rude. But then, lo and behold, they give you your plate, and it's that really big piece of pie, and you're so really happy, but you kind of don't wanna gloat because you don't wanna call the gods down on you. And, you want your friends to still like you, even though you're eating pie that maybe they should have gotten some of that. So I'm just saying, I'm really happy, but I'm just gonna keep things kind of calm, and I'm gonna eat my pie. Every damn bite of it.
I think I'm speaking for everyone here that says, do what you gotta do, but just keep doing what you're doing. Because it really does, speaking now only for myself, there are times when I'm reading your stories that I just absolutely, it's the catch in the breath that we all want to think that we make in people's life. She did that. How did she do that?
Oh, thank you.
I'd like you to read one section from your title story that I kept reading over and over again, thinking I'd find the cipher for how this is done. Maybe a formula that I could study up on and get it. I can't. But I'm so pleased with the miracle of you doing it over and over again. So, do you mind reading this another?
Oh, no, of course. A lot easier to read it than it is to write it.
Maybe after this, we can think about turning this over to the questions and curiosities of the people who, and by the way, I think I'm speaking for you again, to have a room full of people listening to this blather is like going to the shrink and not getting a bill for it. So we're both really grateful to all of you for coming here and listening to this, but we would like to engage your own curiosity. So this is the point at which you should start forming questions, because if there are no questions, I have like a 2-hour poetry reading that's just waiting for the right group to unleash it on. And I know Bonnie Jo has story after story after story that would inure to our benefit.
About castrating the pigs, and you know, we can.
Anything
go
you
on
want
about.
To write about is okay with me. But this part actually takes my breath away. I didn't lose it. It's here.
And I do make really good chocolate candy, and I'm happy to share my recipe with you.
I believe outside
really
they have some,
of.
Don't they? Well, Bonnie Jolt candles?
Well, I have to say, like, it's weird. You write a story, and you think you got a good story, and people around you, like, they kind of like to read it sometimes. But I tell you what, if you make really good candy, and the only reason I know is because my grandmother taught me how, but you make really good candy, people really like it, and they really tell you, and they want it again and again, and they want more of it. So it's hard with stories, because you're not, they like it, they read it once, they move on. But with the candy, you can get the joy again and again, the joy of giving.
I've noticed that.
Yeah.
Can you start here where it says, when I was a teenager?
Okay.
And just read until the end of this.
Okay. And you know, it's great, the light. Lately when I've read, I keep forgetting I need reading glasses, and I have to borrow some from the audience, but like I'm standing in this bright light, and so it's really great, I can actually see. Okay, so start when I was a teenager.
Oh, please.
Okay, this whole story is a ridiculous story to write, impossible. It's like a woman lying on her deathbed, basically having a monologue inside her head about her life, but it's monologued to her daughter. And she's trying to basically explain herself to her daughter, who is middle-aged.
Yeah, I don't mean to interrupt you. This woman has end-stage lung cancer. She's had a stroke. She has no speaking ability. She can hear, she says.
Yeah.
She says to no one that she's not speaking aloud. And it is one long soliloquy that is over too soon as far as we're concerned. All by way of saying, at the end of all of this, there's a table with books for sale, Bonnie Jo's brand new book, 24 Hours Out in the World. And for all those people by whom you're vexed around holiday times, you know, they seem to have everything, they don't have that.
That's right, they don't, do they?
They don't have that. And this will improve them in all ways. And it'll improve their notions of you if you give it to them. They'll never forget you or forgive you, but it'll change their lives.
And I'll sign it. I'll be happy to sign it to see. I've never read this part a lot. I mean, since the book's come out, so we'll see. When I was a teenager, my friend Julia said one day, we got to look pretty. I shaved my legs for the first time, and it took a long while to stop the bleeding. Us and two other friends got hold of a six-pack, though we didn't like the taste of beer. We carried the bottles to where some men lived and reclined on their couch, ankles crossed. We didn't know how to talk to men, so we just smiled, and silence hung above the bag of pretzels they brought out until the men started to laugh, until we laughed with them. They were older and muscular and smelled of smoke and solvents from the repair shops where they worked. One man had a glass eye, said he'd been shot. When he popped it out, we were all possessed by a powerful desire to hold the blind thing in our hands. Julia touched it first and passed it around. She got pregnant right away, and the rest of us followed. And for a lot of years, we raised our children, fed our husbands, worked hard at low-paying jobs or jobs that didn't pay at all, and learned just how tired a body could be. Those men took me by surprise, but I never looked back, never stopped singing love songs, never longed for a time before men. Men's machines still sing to me, revving chainsaw, motorboat, log splitter, rototiller, leaf blower, generator, humming, cordless, drill, rattle, trap, tractor, power, washer, hedge trimmer, biting grinder, motorcycles with mufflers torn off, diesel trucks chugging in the driveway. You remember those men who came to me after a fishing trip up north and filled my wringer washer with smelt. Come out with us and play, men used to call like tomcats, and out I went. That old wringer washer was never the same after all them fish. The men who came around never passed up an easy target, so they killed all the rabbits. I meant to sew a blanket from the soft skins to replace my own skin, which I imagined wadded up under a bed in my room, smeared with menstrual blood, stiff with sperm, stretched by pregnancy. For years, I'd warmed myself in the borrowed skins of men. I was good at cutting pelts from flesh, muscle from bone. After partying all night, a passed out man might resemble a great cut of meat in my bed or on the couch or the floor, leathery bronze shoulders and a fish white behind. Men inhaled great swaths of oxygen, exhaled smoke and sweat, so sometimes I could scarcely catch my breath. I remember finding you and your brothers fishing through a man's wallet like grubby elves. Shoo, shoo, I said, and the men slept on. After your daddy left, I tried to raise you to know men and not to fear them so you wouldn't be taken by surprise. I figured that if any of them bothered you, you'd make a fuss, the way you made a fuss when I wanted you to get out of bed early and haul buckets of water from the creek when the pipes froze. Of course you were scared of your daddy. He was a fearsome man, and he scared me too. But you could have whined and glared at them other men the way you did at your poor, worn-out ma who tried to feed and clothe you with no money. How was I supposed to know there was trouble with the way they pulled you onto their laps if you never told me you didn't like it? It seemed like you were having fun when they said how pretty you were. You were never the kind of kid who smiled, so I couldn't tell.
Yeah, whatever you're doing, keep doing that. I think Doug is going to be around with a microphone and so I think the international sign for I have a question or a comment will do. And you can begin whenever you like to.
I don't want to disappoint you, but it won't be Doug at this moment. It'll be me. I'll try to do a good job.
We'll do fine. Work away.
Hi, Thomas. Hi, Bonnie. Thanks for coming. First of all, Bonnie, we have a table out front for Michigan writers. And I just want to make sure everyone in the audience knows all the great ideas and tips and info you have for writers on your website. It's really, really fabulous, really, really helpful. So thank you for that. In our community, next month, we're going to have a Human Rights Commission forum on youth homelessness. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about homelessness in all your writing or the concept of home. Maybe talk a little bit about that.
Gosh, that's an interesting, makes me think I should write an essay about it. That's really an interesting thing to think about in writing. You know, the one, I had a very stable upbringing in the sense that I always had a home. I had a place, I lived my whole life in the house my grandfather built that my mother lived, my mother was basically born in, that she lived in, and that she still lives in. And so that's, the thought to me of not having a place that's home is terrifying. Like I almost feel tears coming to my eyes right now thinking about it. And in my fiction, I mean, I do write about young people who don't have a place. And certainly I write about people whose place is insecure all the time. And people who long to have a place. There's one story in the collection about a woman who's a very bad mother. She's, by all accounts, she's trying, but she's not doing well in the eyes of the world for her kids. And what she just longs for is she's in a place and she knows she's gonna get kicked out. And she's just longing, isn't there a world where there's just a place where we could each have a room, just a place, and maybe then and a closet, a place you could put your things in. And it's funny, because actually in my house I have no closets, but I think that's a good thing for a grown-up, because you're forced to face everything you own all the time when you have no closets. I guess I do think about it all the time. I don't quite know what more to say about it, but I think that I guess when I create characters, if they don't have a secure home, that is a very large part of the desperation of their characters. I would go so far as to say, you know, if you're thinking about the, you know, I mean, it goes back to the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you don't have shelter, you can't have anything above that. You can't even aspire or desire all that stuff that you need to make the really complicated, the ways of succeeding in this world. You can't do anything unless you have that secure place. So thank you for doing what you're doing for the organization.
The questioner was Susan Odgers.
Hi, I'm Bonnie. I noticed you used the word ditch water for somebody's hair. I've heard of dishwater, but not dish water. Where'd that come from?
I know, I talk to people, I call somebody a ditch water blonde, and I did a little research on the term. I think the ditch water was the original term, ditch water blonde, and we've changed it to dish water because we don't think about ditch water as often as we think about dish water. It's always fun seeing these things change. I love that woman who does that show on Michigan radio where she talks about how words change.
Ann Carson? Or, no, not
what
Ann
is
Carson.
Her name? And, she's a professor.
Yeah. She's an English.
And I think ditch water, and it's funny because I actually live in a neighborhood where ditch water is still a problem because the drainage doesn't work. It's kind of a, you know, I could talk about this for a long time over a glass of wine, but it's a big deal when you live in a low-lying area that the drainage system work. But yeah, ditch water, it was actually kind of a little thrill to me to learn that because I like the notion of ditch water more than I like the notion of dish water because dish water isn't really blonde, you know? I don't know. I guess ditch water might not be either, but aren't words great?
Hi, Bonnie. Thank you for being here, and Thomas as well. I noticed that you have a photo of Flannery O'Connor in the lobby. Tell us about your relationship with her.
I hope that some of you will take advantage and have your photo taken with Flannery O'Connor because she is traveling with me on my book tour. Flannery O'Connor is a great inspiration to me. I'd like to say she's an influence. We'll figure out later in about maybe 20 years whether that worked out. But she is a master storyteller at getting at the brutal truth of things to the heart with no mercy. And she had something that I don't have. She was a faithful Catholic who really believed, for example, she was eating the body of Christ on Sunday, and she also thought that God really was going to sort it all out. And I think that made her literary project slightly different than it would have been otherwise. Her literary project took into account a particular God, and I think about that. I'm reading Flannery O'Connor. I have to go to the Library of Congress to talk about her in March. Can you believe me, Michigan girl, at the Library of Congress? It's going to be fun. And so I'm reading every night. I'm reading some Flannery O'Connor, and I'm just not getting tired of it. I'm enjoying right now. She has a great essay that starts out. I don't know if you've read this one, Tom, but it's an essay about people came to her because she was a kind of a realist writer writing about the gritty stuff and said, you're not a good American writer because many good things happen in America and you just make it sound like it's all living in the dump, you know? And her defense against that argument, her defense about why it was not un-American to describe the rough edges of this American country. It's a beautiful essay. And anyway, I just really admire her, and so I have brought her with me, and I think it's worth taking a photo of her. And if you would do me a favor, if you take a photo with her, I have a Facebook page called Travels with Flannery, and I would love it if you'd post it there.
It actually brings up a question that I wanted to ask about what I think is the connection. We talked about this afternoon at the university or at the college about your handling of the grotesque as Flannery would see it, and some of the writers of her generation would see it. But you do not share that, and I might be supposing this. Maybe you can tell us. I really wanted to talk about religion and sex and politics. Do you don't share a praxis of or any theological notions similar to hers?
No.
Do you have any compensating mythologies?
You know what? For me, it's all right here. It's up to us. And that is far more terrifying than being able to rely on a God to sort it out. So the human, for me, it's all up to the human family to make sense of this every day and to create love and kindness enough to get us all through it. And we have to bring everybody along. We have to bring along.
I think the Gospel of John says exactly the same thing.
Maybe I am not so. My friend Susan always tells me that I'm not far away, but I feel that even the difficult people, we need to bring them with us. And I don't know how to do it, but I'm looking.
I think the two articles of faith that you must retain are, if there's a God, it's not me. And that'll create an awful lot of goodwill. And then if there's a God, you should find it in one another. God is love, says the evangelist, and she who abides in love abides in God and God in her, period. So I think you're saying the same thing, but Flannery compounded it with all those bishops and boyos and the funny outfits and the great hats, as we say. Preaching to bishops is like farting at skunks.
Hi, my name is Rebecca. Besides Flannery O'Connor, can you tell me some of the books you've been reading the last couple of years that you've really enjoyed?
I can think of some story. I really love that new story collection by Elizabeth McCracken. And she's a writer who somehow gets kind of slips through the cracks. Just read everything she's written. She's just gorgeous. She has a memoir, she has a couple books of stories and a couple novels. Elizabeth McCracken, her latest collection is called Thunderstruck. And oddly, actually in reading it, I thought of Tom Lynch's book, Apparitions and Late Fictions, because every single one of these stories about Elizabeth's circles around death. And she has a particular history with a tragedy in her family. And every one of these stories circles around death and yet is so full of life for the way she has done it. Like, the death in her story makes life richer. And these are really beautiful stories. For fun, I love to read Amy Bender. And she has a nice collection of stories that's come out in the last couple years. I can give my agent a plug. There's a great story. Bill Clegg wrote a novel called, "You," and the bookseller might have to correct me, "Once there, Did You Ever Have a Family?" And it's a beautiful story about people moving toward and coming away from a tragedy.
Hello. You talked a little bit about how you start writing stories. Can you talk about when you know that you've hit it, like when you know that you're, how you finish, how you know when you're done?
Yeah, because we always think we're done before we're done, don't we? And it's just hope this is it, hope this revision does it. And then we put it aside a while. Sometimes we know, and time will tell. Sometimes I do advise putting things aside a little while and looking at them again. But often it would behoove us to share it if we are fortunate enough to have friends who would read it and talk about it with us. It doesn't even have to be that your friends have to say if it's done or not. Just allowing, I mean, the most wonderful thing in the world is to write something that matters to you and then create a conversation in the world about that thing you just wrote. So however you can manage to create a conversation about it, that conversation will help you puzzle out whether, and you know you've had this experience in workshops, if you've taken them, or if you've been in a writing group. But there, unfortunately, there's no magical test. You wish you could check the boxes off. Main character, he has a desire. Okay, his desire is thwarted, and you know. And so you just often don't know. And I'm sure you do all the things we all do, which is read those stories aloud, every word of them over and over again, and stick with them. And also, you know, there's always the possibility that it is done, but it could be even better. It could be a better story if you stuck with it even longer and made it richer and more powerful. So there's, if you're willing to stick with the story, I mean, I almost think of those stories as my friends sometimes, you know, because I stick with them a long time and I go back and revisit them and catch up with them and see what's going on. So I have had stories published that later I look at them and see they weren't finished.
Well, I want to thank you, and please give your mother our very best thanks.
Oh, yes. For,
and may your father's memory be eternal. Oh. And thanks for this tonight.
Oh,
God bless
you.
All right, thank you both.
That was Bonnie Jo Campbell talking with Thomas Lynch. Campbell's latest book is Mothers Tell Your Daughters. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.